Case 22-1969, USA versus Scott Chappelle. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Belovitz, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning. Tim Belovitz on behalf of appellant Scott Chappelle, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Fine.
The sentencing appeal is based upon two errors. First, the district court miscalculated the tax loss, finding that it was approximately $1.6 million, which resulted in an offense level of 22 under the tax table. Second, the district court improperly applied the sophisticated means enhancement. The result of these two errors, each of which is a two-level enhancement, two-level increase in the sentencing guidelines, accounted for an adjusted offense level after taking into account a credit for timely acceptance of 21, when in fact it should have been 17, with an advisory guideline range of 20 to 24 months. I'll start first with the tax loss issues, of which there are three.
Do you have to win on each of those three in order to prevail on that issue?
Yes, Judge, we do. Admittedly, we do have to win on each and every one of those three. The first of the three. Let me walk through the three quickly, then I'll go into a little bit more detail with respect to each of them. In calculating the tax loss of approximately $1.6 million, the district court made a total of three errors. The district court included taxes, penalties, and interest that were actually the liabilities of another entity that's not subject to the government sentencing calculation without making factual findings that they, in fact, constituted relevant conduct. That's number one. Number two.
Can I interrupt you right there? What is the possible argument that that's not relevant conduct?
So as an initial matter, Your Honor, from day one in this case, the government set forth a tax loss analysis that did not include this particular set of taxes with respect to this entity. There are several entities, admittedly. And so
it's one of his entities.
It's one of the entities.
He didn't pay taxes.
Right.
He controlled it. How is that any different than what the government did argue in the indictment?
The government did not argue that it was relevant conduct. The government argued.
You don't in the indictment.
Right. No, nor did the government argue.
I'm just asking you, how do you distinguish these taxes from the ones that you don't object to?
Your Honor, that's a finding for the district court to make. The district court has to.
I've been asking you. You have an argument. Is this just a useless exercise to remand it back for her to say relevant conduct?
We would argue that it's up for the judge to make the decision, Your Honor.
But why isn't it relevant conduct? Tell us now.
It is conceivably relevant conduct, but it does pertain to.
You don't have an argument that it isn't relevant conduct.
It pertains to a different entity. It pertains to a different time period, and it would be the judge's responsibility, the district judge's responsibility, to make that determination based upon the facts. And that's simply Denver.
So why, if you don't have an argument, would it not be harmless error, even if you were otherwise right?
Your Honor, we just believe it's for the judge to decide. And is it harmless error? No, I don't believe it is harmless error. It's not harmless error because the judge has to find that it is, in fact, part of the same course of conduct, that the conduct was close enough to meet the relevant conduct.
Is it different conduct?
Your Honor, it is arguably the same conduct. It is arguably, I should say, similar conduct.
Same conduct, same guy, same company that he owned.
But never found by the district court judge by a preponderance.
Okay, we've beaten that to death.
The second issue with respect to the tax loss is that the district judge failed to credit Mr. Chappelle with a refund offset. The third and last error with respect to the tax loss is that the district judge failed to credit Mr. Chappelle with payments made toward penalties and interest. We've talked a bit about the first issue, so in the interest of time, I'll move directly on to the second. The district court failed to apply the refund offset to Mr. Chappelle's tax liabilities pursuant to Section 6402 of the Internal Revenue Code. Under that section, the IRS can apply tax overpayments against the taxpayer's pre-existing tax liabilities. It's called a refund offset. And for tax year 2015, Mr. Chappelle received an individual income tax refund, that is to say a 1040 individual income tax refund in the amount of a little over $38,000. The IRS gave Mr. Chappelle credit for those payments throughout 2015 when he was making the payments. The IRS credits them officially on the on its what they call the transcript when the taxes are due for that tax year. In other words, April 15th of the following year. And that's what happened here. On April 15th, 2016, the standard tax filing due date, the IRS indicated that credit was given for those payments. The government, however, claims that the refund, the relevant date for this issue is October of 2016, so several months later, when Mr. Chappelle filed his 2015 tax return pursuant to an extension. The government says, accordingly, Mr. Chappelle should not get credit because he learned he was under a criminal investigation 5 months earlier in May 11th specifically of 2016. And we don't dispute that. That is, in fact, when Mr. Chappelle learned he was under criminal investigation. The government also claims that the October 2016 date is operative because the amount of the refund was not determinable until Mr. Chappelle filed his 2015 tax return.
Assuming that you're right and the government's wrong about that, why do we use that May 2016 date when there was the interview, when he's pled guilty to an indictment that charges him with these offenses going back to, I think it's 2010?
Right. The government itself gives credit after the date of awareness. And it's critical throughout the government's filings, throughout the government's briefs. There were times when the government would refer to the date on which he learned of the criminal investigation, the date of awareness. And again, Your Honor, there are instances where...
So you're saying it's only awareness, it's not the date of the offense?
We are arguing that the date of awareness, pursuant to the government's own position, is really the operative date here.
But is there a law that supports that being the operative date? What case or regulation or statute would you point to?
I cannot put my finger on a statute. I cannot put my finger on a case. What I can do is say that's what the government has, that's the position the government has maintained. And frankly, it stands to reason that, particularly in a tax case, that the date of awareness should be the operative date. That's when the defendant knows that there is, in fact, a criminal investigation. There's not merely some other sort of civil matter or administrative collection effort. With taxes, as the court is well aware, there are all sorts of enforcement mechanisms. Criminal is not the only one.
So no court, to your awareness, has made a ruling on this issue?
Not this particular specific issue. That's right, Your Honor. I'll move on quickly in the interest of time to the third tax issue. The district court failed to credit Mr. Chappelle with payments he made toward penalties and interest. Now, if the court looks at the guidelines, the central point here is that where the guidelines say taxes paid after the commission of an offense do not reduce the tax loss, there is no such prohibition on the payment of interest and penalties. Specifically, Guideline Section 2T1.1C5 provides the tax loss is not reduced by the payment of the tax subsequent to the commission of the offense. Mr. Chappelle paid the penalties and interest at issue here in September of 2018 after he knew he was under criminal investigation. But because 2T1.1 does not apply to penalties and 2T1.1C5, excuse me, does not apply to penalties and interest, the timing does not matter. And as I mentioned a moment ago, the government itself credited Mr. Chappelle with payments toward penalties and interest in November of 2016, long after he had learned he was under criminal investigation. The central point here, however, is that tax loss and tax are not synonymous. In one part of the guideline, tax loss is specifically defined as having three components: tax, penalties, and interest. And that's in Application Note 1, which defines tax loss for evasion of payment and evasion and failure to pay cases. Specifically includes those three components. Each of these three things is different. For other offenses, however, tax loss does not include penalties and interest, and it's limited only to tax. In other words, for all the tax offenses other than those two. In the provision at issue itself, 2T1.1C5, tax loss is specifically limited to only one of those components, and that's tax itself. The central point here is that where different words are used in a statute, they have different meanings.
So again, do you have a case that addresses this particular point?
I have cases that, not this particular point, but I have cases where tax is defined differently under various tax scenarios, and we've listed those. Sometimes penalties are included, sometimes not, but the statute always says what is within the four corners of the definition.
Okay, and your red light is on. I know you've saved 5 minutes, and you said you had another issue. You can choose to use your rebuttal time now for your other issue, or you can...
I would like to do that, Your Honor. Thank you. So just to round this out, Your Honor asked about other scenarios in which penalties and interest are considered to fall within the definition of tax. The trust fund recovery penalties, that's one. The Affordable Care Act, reporting for noncompliance, and a fourth is accuracy-related penalties. In each and every one of these instances, which are included in the appellant's brief, there is a definition that includes that says specifically whether taxes include penalties and whether penalties and interest are synonymous with taxes. In other words, if the drafters could have included penalties and interest in the rule set forth in 2T1.1C5, as they did in the definition of tax loss in Application Note 1 to this guideline section, but they didn't. They just said tax, and that's what they meant.
So back to our earlier question, where you agreed that you had to succeed on all three of these challenges to the amount of the loss. If we reject one of those, can you think off the top of your head any reason why anybody would benefit for us going on talking about the other two?
Well, as a matter of fact, I can, Your Honor, just for sake of clarity. So that the next appellant doesn't come before the court with the same issues and doesn't get tripped up. So I would offer that as a justification for doing it.
All right, thank you.
I take the court's point. I understand. We have to prevail on all three. I'd like now to turn my attention to the sophisticated means issue. The central point here is that the district court improperly applied a two-level enhancement, again, under Section 2T1.1.
Now, when we're looking at this, are we considering sophisticated means as it relates to a reasonable person, or is it a reasonable real estate developer? So what sort of the lens we look through?
You know, Your Honor, the case law doesn't really address whether it's sort of that reasonable person standard or whether you take the defendant as he or she comes with respect to their background and their career. But what the guidelines in the case law, well, I'll start with the guidelines. What the guidelines do say clearly is that sophisticated means especially complex or especially intricate offense conduct pertaining to the execution or concealment of the offense. The guidelines make clear that the method of carrying out the offense must be more than just complex or intricate. It must be especially so. And as the district court explained in Hulsey, U.S. v. Hulsey, from the Middle District of Alabama in 2013, what this means is that the level of complexity or intricacy must set that particular scheme apart from ordinary schemes. Even ordinarily complex or intricate schemes. Now, the guidelines don't stop there. The guidelines also recognize in the notes the following: although tax offenses always involve some planning, unusually sophisticated efforts to conceal the offense decrease the likelihood of detection and therefore warrant an additional sanction for deterrence purposes.
One of the things that I was confused about in reading your brief was you seem to be arguing that in the real estate area, it's common to form probably LLCs. You raise investors, so each property, apartment, complex, whatever it is, has a different entity. That seemed to be the thrust of the argument in the brief, but that's not the issue here. It wasn't these other LLCs that Mr. Chappelle had that were part of this offense. This is just his company that went through these three or four different variations of name changes and transferring accounts. So I couldn't figure out what difference your argument about separate LLCs to hold real estate mattered in this particular case.
Well, Your Honor, the one company, these are called management companies, to be distinguished from the LLCs that hold the individual properties. The management company, which went from one name to another over a period of time, also went through that process in order to protect against creditors. So a creditor might get a judgment with respect to one company, but can't get it with respect to the new company. This is strictly for creditors who have a claim with respect to a particular project, so that the entire enterprise is not put at risk.
So the argument is it's customary to change the name of the management company in the real estate industry?
It is. In addition to the LLCs, they're just commonplace to do this sort of thing. Now, the district judge said that she put it vertigo looking at this, and I understand that. This is a very complex structure. The point is simply that it's not unusually sophisticated. It's not especially complex, rather, or especially intricate.
But you just used the word, it's very complex.
It is, oh, to
be
sure.
But it's not especially complex.
What I'm saying is that the structure is complex for legitimate purposes of the real estate business. It's not especially complex for purposes of trying to conceal the offense. That's the point here. Tax offenses, I'll close by simply saying this. Tax offenses are by their nature complex. Tax evasion offenses are by their very nature even more complex. So we're not starting off with a run-of-the-mill wire fraud or mail fraud scheme. You're already starting off with a level of complexity that frankly is pretty high. So to add that additional two-level enhancement, it's got to be even that much higher than your run-of-the-mill tax evasion scheme.
Thank you.
May it please the court,
Hannah Cook for the United States.
Your Honors, the district court did not err in determining that the tax loss from defendant's scheme exceeded $1.5 million and that the scheme, which, as the court noted, gave the district court vertigo, constituted sophisticated means. As this court's aware, defendant engaged in a multi-year pyramiding scheme in which he moved his business, which my colleague has conceded is one business, it's the business. Called it Terra Management, called it Strathmore Development, called it Terra Holdings, called it Chappelle, in order to evade the IRS's efforts to collect the payment of past due employment taxes that had been withheld from the employee's pay but were not turned over to the IRS. Turning first to the tax loss issue, which, as the courts noted, defendant needs to win on all three issues in order for the guidelines range to be impacted, so this court need reach only any one of the three issues. But first, as to relevant conduct. The 2015 Q3 and Q4 taxes were always a part of this case. The PSR notes at page ID 656 that at the taxpayer conference, that's a pre-indictment conference, the government provided a table of all of the taxes that it thought were at issue, and those included the Q3 and Q4 of 2015 taxes. They were, however, attributed to defendant's second entity, Strathmore, because when defendant filed the payroll tax returns, the forms 941, which are in the record, he used Strathmore's EIN, employer identification number, but put the name Terra Holdings, suggesting, as he later admitted in his plea agreement, that this was really one company, they weren't separate, and he was at that point in time in the process of transferring the business from Strathmore to Terra Holdings. So the IRS, when it received the tax returns, keyed in that taxpayer identification number, up popped Strathmore, it attributed those taxes to Strathmore. But they were already considered to be a part of this offense, a part of the offense conduct, essentially, for the purposes of this offense. Later on, the government's initial spreadsheets also included it, as it was labeled as Strathmore relevant conduct under the plea agreement, because defendants plea was only for two quarters particularly, or included information about those two, but it was still in there. It's in the PSR as Strathmore Q3, Q4. Defendant has never argued that that number is wrong, indeed it's the number that he provided, or that this wasn't a part of, to Judge McKeague's point, the same evasive scheme. And the district court so found, although it didn't use the term relevant conduct, because defendant never challenged that it was relevant conduct. If you look in his objections to the PSR, his sentencing memorandum, and the sentencing transcript, you'll never see an argument that says this isn't relevant conduct. It doesn't use the term relevant conduct. The only mention of relevant conduct in the sentencing briefing is to a footnote in the government sentencing memo at page ID 715, where the government notes defendant had made the argument after the PSR had been finalized but before sentencing that actually these two quarters were meant to be Terra Holdings, not Strathmore, to which the government said, okay, even so, they're relevant conduct. That's footnote 2 of the government sentencing memo.
You know, just out of curiosity, I should know the answer to this, I don't, but we've been proceeding with the assumption that he went from one company to another to another. Did he actually dissolve the former company and file articles of incorporation of the new company when he changed these names, or did he just keep doing business under a new name?
I don't know about state incorporation documents or anything like that. I don't believe that's in the record. I do believe he registered for separate employer identification numbers, but otherwise the business operated as normal, same everything. And indeed, part of the conduct he pled to in his plea agreement was depositing checks from various entities to accounts held in the names of the different businesses. So I don't think there's any dispute that this is being operated as one business. He's just registering for new tax numbers to get away from the prior debt.
Mr. Belova says it's common in the industry to close one management company and own another management company to avoid possible liabilities. Is that in the record?
That's not it. Regarding the commonplaceness, I don't believe so. But when you engage in that sort of scheme for tax purposes, it's criminal tax evasion under 26 U.S.C. 7201. So I would say it's certainly not common to engage in it to evade IRS tax debts, or at least I very much hope it's not. But to the relevant conduct argument, the district court, when it was sentencing Mr. Chappelle, found that Terra Holdings was part of his scheme. And I'd point the court to page 928 of the record, where, and I'll just read you the little two-sentence blurb. Here's what the district court said when summarizing the scheme. Mr. Chappelle owns Terra Management from 1997 until 2009, when he just turns off the faucets, opens up a new company, and tries to run with that, right, with Strathmore Development, until he shuts that down and he begins Terra Holdings. And then he shuts that down and he opens Chappelle Development. This is a series of corporate transactions that have no purpose from what I can tell other than to hide or run from debt. That's a finding that this is the same scheme or course of conduct. The district court didn't use a magic word that the defendant hadn't asked it to use, but that's a factual finding. And I don't even know what the district court would say if this was sent back. The district court's already expressed its view on this issue. The two quarters, even if they were Terra Holdings, are relevant conduct, and that's enough to end this case. But moving just to the refund offset issue. What defendant is arguing is that the withholdings made by his and his wife's employers for personal income taxes for 2015 should be credited essentially to his business's employment tax liabilities and his trust fund recovery penalty. That is simply not how tax law works. If you think about how withholdings come in, they come in from an employer for a particular taxpayer, which is keyed to their social security number or EIN, and for a particular year and a particular type of tax. That's why when you see on the account transcripts, which is Exhibit 5 to defendant's sentencing memo, it's got the two taxpayers, taxpayer identification numbers, and the period.
So these were withholdings for their personal income tax.
Personal income taxes.
Liability based on their wages.
Yes.
Withheld by the employer is the standard thing that everybody who's an employee knows about.
Exactly. And it's both of them. It's that because they were married and were filing jointly, that's two streams into the one bucket.
And then in the end, when they finally file their tax, their personal tax returns, their individual tax returns jointly, they realize that they can claim a refund is at the bottom after they file in October of 2016 for the 2015 year.
Yep, and that's when they say, all right, here's how much you owe us back. Because, of course, especially in a situation where, like, the defendant's a small business owner, the IRS doesn't have a full picture of their financial circumstances, what their business expenses are, what their income is, whether they have any real estate holdings, which defendant did, although they were in the name of nominees.
So is there any law, whether it's statute, regulation, or case, that says that the refund on one's personal individual income tax can or cannot be used if in the appropriate time frame to offset this tax loss on the business side?
Your Honor, the governing statute is the refund offset statute. It's 26 U.S.C. 6402. Mm-hmm. And what that says is, in the case of any overpayment, the Secretary may credit, I'm eliding here, so there's somebody in the middle. The Secretary may credit the amount of such overpayment, and then I'm skipping a little bit more, against a tax liability, quote, of the person who made the overpayment. This presents a few problems for defendant. The first, obviously, is the use of the term may. The IRS has the ability, but not the obligation, to credit overpayments from 1 year against liabilities due in another year. That's been frequently held by the tax court. I would point, for example, to Ruggieri versus Commissioner, which is a 2013 tax court case. It's found at 2013 Westlaw 5745820. It's also cited in our brief. And that says, essentially, if you think of these Social Security numbers as, you know, we've got the one bucket, and then there's sort of these vertical columns. That's that taxpayer identification number, but for different years. So if I owe income taxes for 2015 and I file my 2016 return and I have a refund, the IRS can but does not have to. And the Georgia case from the Federal Circuit, 67 Fed CL 598, holds that the IRS has no obligation to credit any individual's tax overpayment to specific pre-existing outstanding tax liabilities. So the IRS can but doesn't have to apply it to something owed by that Social Security number.
And this may be completely aside, but so with respect to the refund on the individual tax return that's apparently owed, the IRS could simply pay the refund in dollars to the individual taxpayer and his spouse.
Correct. And
but the key provision is 6402A, which is talking about crediting against any liability on the part of the person who made the overpayment.
Yes, and this is the other key point, is it's of the taxpayer. So here...
But why does that help here when what we're talking about is trust fund recovery penalties, where the individual becomes liable for the failure to remit by the company?
Because of defendant's wife. So defendant's wife was not involved in his business dealings, and she is not responsible for the trust fund recovery penalties. They haven't been assessed against her. And indeed, if you look at Exhibit 5 of the sentencing memo, that's
so you're saying basically that he can't make the argument that that should have been credited to his trust fund recovery payments because it was owned jointly by his wife.
I'm saying essentially, a little bit of nuance on that is that the portion of the withholdings that are attributable to his wife cannot be touched by the IRS for his tax debt, and that's especially true because she's filed what's called an injured spouse claim. You'll see that on the transcript. What an injured spouse claim is for is exactly the scenario, which says, I'm married to this person who owes a large tax debt, but these withholdings were mine. I'm entitled to my refund, sort of as if she'd filed separately. So IRS, figure out what amount of the refund is, portion it, and give me my portion.
And what portion just is her portion?
That's not in the record.
Okay.
But we know that...
Interestingly enough, I mean, if what you're ending up saying is that a portion of this, what was it, $38,000, whatever it was, a portion of it is actually his wife's.
Yes.
So does that take you, does he need that full amount to get below the $1.5 million?
I don't know that this court can say that because we don't know how much, it's not in the record how much that amount is, but I think what this court can say is that he certainly was not entitled to the full amount of the refund in 2015, which is what he needs, because he files in October of 2016. So we're sort of in a different universe. Defendant essentially wants to go into a parallel universe in which he is entitled to this refund. He's entitled to it prior to May of 2016, which is when he is interviewed by IRS criminal investigation, which is basically the most conservative, latest date possible for when he could get credited for payments. And the IRS chose, in its discretion, to put that portion of the refund towards the TFRP he owed, none of which happened.
Okay, but one question that we pursued with your opponent is why are we looking at May 2016 as opposed to earlier?
It's just the most conservative date. The government certainly, and I believe this was actually said at the sentencing hearing, One could certainly have looked at 2010 or 2011, I believe.
If you could, you know, is there any law that tells us what date we should be looking at, or is it that there's no law at all, and therefore taking the most conservative assumption makes sense?
So I would say one go-by is this court's decision in Tandon, which is relevant to defendant's other issue, and I apologize, I know I'm running a little short on time. But in Tandon, what this court said was, certainly defendant's not entitled to payments made after he knows he's under criminal investigation. You know, that's definitely the end. I don't think Tandon can be read to say never before, but it says certainly not after. So that's what the government, that was the government's approach here, which was to say, not conceding certainly that there couldn't be an earlier date, but definitely this is the last possible date, which is what this court used in Tandon. And here, that date's May 2016. There's no universe in which defendant could have gotten the IRS if the IRS chose in its discretion to apply some portion of this refund. That's October of 2016. We're out of time, which is what the district court concluded as well.
Can you address the sophisticated means issue? I know we'll rely on your brief for the other issues.
Certainly. Defendant here absolutely used sophisticated means. He engaged in using multiple entities. And although he's using the four entities, which to my mind may very well be enough to avoid the liability of the past due employment taxes, he's also using other companies as well as other sophisticated mechanisms, including fake liens. He twice submitted, and he admitted to this, and it's in the PSR, he submitted false lien documents to a bank saying that this entity called Chasco Management had hundreds of thousands of dollars in liens. That allowed, so when the bank remortgaged the property, it sent these hundreds of thousands of dollars to this entity controlled by defendant, who was then able to distribute it to other entities and basically cash out without having that money flow through his personal account or the accounts of any of the businesses that owed employment taxes. He's also doing this on the personal side, which is relevant because he's got these TFRPs that are assessed against him personally. And the PSR goes through hundreds of thousands of dollars of personal expenses, his mortgage payments, tuition for his children, personal travel to vacation spots, that he's pulling out of business bank accounts to avoid having money in his own name that the IRS could collect to get the TFRP, because you can't as an individual get a new social security number when you owe too much tax debt. So he's just keeping money out of his name. And this court and other courts have repeatedly held that that constitutes sophisticated means. I know we cited a number of cases in our brief, but I'd point this court to, for example, Tandon, which said that when a defendant uses business bank accounts and is holding money in other accounts, that's sophisticated. There's also Dalton, where this court held that a trucker who claimed trucking-specific, difficult-to-check credits, that was sophisticated because he's using his industry knowledge to conceal the offense. He's using what he knows to make it hard for the IRS to catch him. So too here, defendant's using his knowledge of the real estate industry. He's using mortgages and liens and all of these LLCs that he's registered in order to play this game of hide the ball with the IRS, in order to keep that. And the fact that they're registered, I'm out of time. Thank you so much. We'd ask that the court affirm if the court has no more questions.
Thank you.